Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Of the 8 FedEx workers killed by a gunman in Indianapolis last week, 4 of the victims were Sikh, a faith community connected to the Punjab region of India. Authorities say they haven't determined whether the gunman was targeting Sikh workers, but a coalition of Sikh leaders is now imploring the Biden administration to tackle the long-standing problem of hate crimes against Sikh communities. Let's bring in K.P. Singh. He's an artist and leader of Sikh Satsang of Indianapolis, one of the largest temples in the city. K.P., welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Mosley. Pleasure.
Pleasure to have you. You know, KP, I know it's been a heavy and traumatic last few days for you. I want to first express my condolences and also ask how you're doing today.
Very kind of you to express your condolences. We are expressing in the Sikh community, the loss is not just of the members of the Sikh congregation here. There are losses of all 8 precious lives. Yes, 4 of them happen to be Sikhs. And so we are especially grieving that part because we are not a very large community. When I came to the city of Indianapolis after my graduation at the University of Michigan, there were only 1 or 2 Sikhs. Today there are maybe as many as 5,000 to 7,000 Sikhs here. And so they're all stunned in disbelief.
This tragedy, I can imagine, feels painfully familiar. In 2012, 6 Sikh people were shot to death at a temple in Wisconsin known as the Oak Creek shooting. And after 9/11, Sikhs were targeted by people who confused Sikhs as Muslims. You know, KP, I can imagine this particular point is painful too, to be mistaken for another group that we know is also unfairly targeted because of ignorance and prejudice. What has the healing process looked like for the Sikh community over the last few days there in Indianapolis?
Ms. Mosley, if I can say that, it has been incredibly reassuring how many people of every faith, culture, community, in a very affectionate way, they have reached out personally to K.P. Singh because I've been here so long, but they have reached out to the Sikh community in very formal and very informal and almost like a family-like way. It's reassuring that we as Americans, not just as necessarily as Sikhs or individual faiths, rally to that kind of challenge as one family.
And now there is this effort, this push to have the White House to take on this effort of healing. In a letter to the White House on Saturday, the Sikh coalition implored the administration to tackle this longstanding concern that hate crimes against Sikhs go undetected and unchallenged. And among the ideas, the coalition is asking for the appointment of a Sikh liaison in the White House and a public awareness campaign about what it means to be a Sikh American. What would you like a public awareness campaign to look and sound like?
Ms. Mosley, I have been an advocate that by learning about one another, we can dispel distrust, we can dispel stereotyping, we can dispel identity issues with regard to mistaken identity. So when we are talking about liaison, I am not limiting myself to a liaison just at the White House, which is very important, but I'm thinking of a liaison at every level.
The coalition is also asking for President Biden to meet with the impacted families in Indiana and the Sikh American community on the next anniversary of the Oak Creek shooting, which will be on August 5th. If he takes the coalition up on that offer, what would you like to say to him?
That we should be really thinking about this lingering challenge for the Sikhs who don't wear a turban because they want to please you, Ms. Mosley. They don't wear it because they want to displease you. The whole idea of being able to wear your articles of faith and to be accepted that as a police officer, to be accepted that in the military, to be accepted that in our job situations. Sikhs have been in this great blessed country for over 125 years. They have paid their dues, and it is time that they are looked at as equal citizens who deserve just a little nudge. We will do the heavy lifting.
KP, you mentioning that Sikhs have been in this country for more than 125 years, it got me thinking about your art. And what struck me most about your drawings of these beautiful skylines and landscapes is that we're seeing through your eyes the beauty of Indianapolis and really this country of ours. Your art is kind of a love letter to this country. Do you feel this country loves you back?
Absolutely, Ms. Mosley, absolutely, because the drawings really came about as a result of the city of Indianapolis deciding to tear down some historic buildings. They are part of a heritage. We will never have those structures 2,000 years old as they are all over India if we just keep creating parking lots and destroying the structures that are 150, 175 years old. So my argument all throughout these years has been that we are really not that far apart as you think, that there is the same reverberating thought that is really running through the scriptures in terms of the power of God, the glory of God, loving another human being, all humanity being one, one people, one brotherhood.
Mm. KP Singh, local leader in the Indianapolis Sikh community. KP, thank you so much for this conversation.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure for this great opportunity, and you have a blessed and beautiful day.
To the state of New Mexico now, where 56% of residents over the age of 16 have now received at least one dose of the coronavirus vaccine. 38% are fully vaccinated. It's one of the highest vaccination rates in the country. And that's worth noting because New Mexico is also one of the poorest states in the country, with limited healthcare resources. Dr. Tracy Collins is the state's Secretary of Health. Dr. Collins, welcome. You know, more populous states have used football or baseball stadiums to get people vaccinated on a mass scale, but you don't really have that there in New Mexico. How are you getting all those shots into arms?
Well, so it's like a multiple approaches. Okay, so we have EMS, we're partnering with emergency medical services, going to people's homes, going out to areas that are remote, and working with pharmacies. We have more landmass here in New Mexico. So this idea of trying to use a large venue, it works well in the Albuquerque area, maybe Las Cruces, up in Santa Fe. But in these very remote areas, we've got to go out and set up these pods. And so we have our public health offices, our public health division. It really has done a great job early on in the pandemic with testing, using these pods. And now we're using these pods to deliver vaccines. So it's like having a grocery store with an area in a parking lot set up, or where they someone can go to a smaller community outreach area and get their vaccine. The large events do have some value, but it's more so that special touch of using the pods and even mobile vaccine units to reach these remote areas. And I just want to add, we also have a FUMU, a FEMA urban mobile unit that we've set up in a parking lot. We actually had several people show up just as we had the issue with J&J and we had to switch to Moderna, but we were able to have people walk up, get registered, and get their vaccine.
How much do you think your vaccine campaign has improved the number of infections and deaths that you've been seeing in your state?
Well, we have seen a nice plateau. We saw a drop and now we're plateauing. And we feel like given the number of shots in arms relative to the drop in cases we've seen, that we're doing quite well to try and get ahead of COVID-19.
Do you feel like the worst is over in the state of New Mexico?
I wish I could say the worst was over. I think we just need to be diligent and continue with best practices, mask wearing, distancing, just really adhering to what's going to keep us safe until we can get as many New Mexicans vaccinated as possible.
Will, to that point, your governor wants to be the first state in the country to reach herd immunity with at least 70% of the population vaccinated. It may actually have to be higher than that. Do you think it's realistic? Can you reach herd immunity in New Mexico?
I think we can certainly reach more than 60% of New Mexicans being vaccinated. We're really within that goal. The issue with herd immunity at this point is that this virus is, we're constantly learning about it. And so we may actually need a booster dose in the future. So I think when you think about herd immunity, you really want to be cautious in that the fact that you really have to get enough people vaccinated so that you don't see this virus replicate and then potentially mutate again. It's just herd immunity can be a bit tricky given how this virus continues to change.
Well, and I wonder how you're targeting people like conservative men in rural areas. Of course, New Mexico is a pretty rural state. We know that many people in that group don't want to get vaccinated. How are you trying to reach them?
It's a matter of finding the champions in those communities, the evangelicals, those white males who may think, no, thanks on the vaccine, to find someone who they can identify with, who actually has gotten the vaccine and really believes in it, and use that person to work with us, to work with those communities.
Dr. Tracy Collins is the Secretary of Health for the state of New Mexico. Dr. Collins, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
A few years ago, when Jade Lozada was in high school, she was given a task to think about how climate change has impacted her life. It was something up until that moment she hadn't considered because she was never really a science person.
Absolutely not. Actually, in high school, I really had a connection to writing.
After some thought, 18-year-old Lozada realized she could use her writing as a form of activism. She sat down and wrote a poem about the changing climate in her hometown of New York City titled The Worst Crime. Here she is reading an excerpt.
The worst crime I know men have committed is to turn nature into an oppressor.
Jade Lozada wrote this searing poem after participating in a program called Girls Write Now, a writing and mentoring nonprofit that encourages Gen Zers to use the power of the pen to enact change.
I have been thinking about my relationship with an environment that does not seem so obvious to the effects of climate change. As someone who was born and raised in the city and never really left to go hiking or camping or things like that, my connection is really to this built environment, not something that is just natural to Earth.
Lozada's generation, known as Gen Zers, are actually some of the most passionate activists behind climate change movements that center social justice. Jade Lozada, along with another participant in Girls Right Now, 17-year-old climate justice activist Jayola Reed, recently joined us to talk about their newfound activism. Reed is from the South Bronx, an area often described as Asthma Alley, where the risk of pediatric asthma rates are 8 times higher than the national average. She began by telling me how she began to put together the impacts of climate change on her family and friends.
So I was always aware of the climate crisis because of the media attention that it had earned. It was actually Friday, September 20th in 2019, that a couple of friends and I had attended the climate strike in Manhattan. So then it had led me to do a lot of research. And next thing I knew, I was educating my mother, my friends, and basically anyone who would listen to me about the environmental inequality that as a result of our socioeconomic status as Bronx residents, we're being subjected to. So although I had lived in the Bronx my whole life, I wasn't explicitly aware of everything that was going on here and the things that were going on for decades, the pollution, the asthma rates, the waste inequity. Somehow it wasn't discussed in schools. I didn't get any proper education on it. So I was really happy when I was able to find out on my own and educate others and then eventually start organizing.
Jayola, what were the conversations like with your parents and really educating them and those you love, like your friends? What were their responses when you start bringing up issues like climate change?
Yeah, so there was at first a huge, huge, I would say, state of like anger, because a lot of us were just upset at the fact that the system truly had failed us, particularly the education system. The fact that they were able to get away with subjecting us to all of this pollution in our own neighborhood and yet not even have a proper lesson about why it's there and who the culprits are. It was very shocking and it was very disappointing that we were so ignorant to this problem that we were dealing with on such a large scale. But after that anger, we were able to get to work, which was really exciting because now my parents are more civically engaged. I definitely, although I'm not old enough to vote yet, I am participating in a lot of civic engagement activities. And we're looking at the officials in our local Bronx area, and we're starting to hold them accountable. We're starting to advocate for people who are running campaigns that will address some of the issues that we're having in the Bronx in terms of our climate. And it's really exciting to see the way that we were able to transition from that, you know, state and phase of just anger and disappointment and shock to a state of being willing to work and now actually advocate for the demands that we need met.
You feel empowered. That's what I'm hearing from you, is that you feel empowered, that you actually can impart change in some way. Jayola, what are some of the ways that your parents have gotten involved?
Yeah, so there are June primaries in New York City where we vote for our local officials. And I think that, you know, my parents were under the impression, like a lot of people are, that your local officials, they don't hold as much power as, say, the president does. But in reality, a lot of the policies that are being passed in your neighborhood that directly affect the policing in your neighborhoods, the zoning in your neighborhood, everything that has to do with any issue that may occur there is really directly put into place and addressed by your local officials. So that means your mayor, that means the New York City comptroller, that means the city council representatives. And so those are people that my parents had maybe overlooked in the past, and they didn't really understand the importance of going out to the polls in June and actually researching these candidates, deciding if they represent those same values and voting for them. It was just something that wasn't a practice. And then after letting them know about the current state that we're living in terms of our climate, and more specifically how the climate crisis doesn't affect us all equally, and unfortunately Bronx residents are getting some of the worst end of this all, they decided that the best way for them to be activists in their own way, because there's so many ways that you can be, but they decided that for them that would be civic engagement. When I let them know the effects of politics on the climate, they did all that they could, and they will be voting in these June primaries, which is very, very exciting, because the people that they vote for are the same people that I'm actually campaigning for. So everything just kind of came around full circle, and I'm just so happy for them to be a part of this and experiencing it.
Jay, this sounds familiar to you as well. You've had conversations with your parents too.
Yeah, I have, and I don't think I have yet been as successful as Jayola. I think my parents are definitely less civically engaged, although they do try to be a little bit more aware of climate change and generally what's going on in the city.
Jade, going from being a demonstrator, you were part of these huge youth-led climate strikes in New York a couple of years ago, to now the kind of work that you're doing now, you feel like you don't necessarily like that form of activism anymore. Why is that, and what did you learn from that experience?
In contrast to what Jayola was saying and her takeaway from the strike where it actually empowered her, I felt like for me as an organizer, it was more of a facade of empowerment, but behind it, I was really feeling that I wasn't making a huge contribution and that the dynamic between the organizers could get really competitive and egotistical. And a lot of the things that we were doing, including like media opportunities and things like that, really involved our ego more than I think some of like our desire to like amplify the message that we were supposed to be sending out. And I would be lying if I said that my ego didn't play a part in it either. When the strike ended and we kind of had to face this new territory of there is no event to revolve our whole lives and egos around anymore, I really had to consider how much I had gained from that and what kind of person it made me. But even on a less deep and introspective level, I knew that I just didn't have the personality to get out on the streets and yell into a megaphone and speak all the time about the issue. It was extremely exhausting for someone like introverted like me, and I just didn't feel like myself.
You bring up an interesting point, because I'm thinking about other young people like you, or just folks who are interested in becoming civically active, but maybe they don't see themselves as someone who's out on the street as part of demonstrations. You've been able to find another way. How would you suggest others who want to tell their own personal stories and also be a part of this effort get started?
That's a great question. I think that when we consider youth activism, we focus so much on that form, really being out on the street and loud about it. But that doesn't play to everyone's strengths, though there's a role in the movement for everyone. I think that it is a combination of being really true to who you are and how you would like to contribute and what kind of work you want to be spending your time on, as well as finding out what is your personal connection to climate change. And climate change is such an intricate issue that intersects with a ton of other social justice issues that may be more obvious and seemingly pertinent to your life. I think you just have to investigate those connections to find where it is that it intersects with climate change and use that as your fuel for your specific role in the movement.
Jayola Reed is 17 and Jade Lozada is 18. They are both climate justice activists in New York City and both will be starting college in the fall. Thank you both for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
This is Here and Now. You may have noticed help wanted signs in many restaurant and storefront windows recently. With COVID restrictions lifting, economists say employers may have trouble finding workers to meet the rising demand. The Maryland convenience store chain Royal Farms is now offering a $500 signing bonus, and there's a McDonald's in Florida paying people $50 just to show up to the interview. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hey, Robin.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Look, the unemployment numbers in this country are getting better, but there's still millions of Americans who are out of work in this pandemic. So how is it possible that some employers could have trouble finding people to fill those jobs right now?
Think about the whiplashing nature of this economy over the past, let's say, 16 months. First, the economic collapse last spring when we locked down, and now the huge surge anticipated coming back out of it. You typically don't fire and rehire many millions of workers at the snap of a finger. Most employers are going to be cautious about committing to new hires. And not that you could just take for granted that there are people waiting to be hired. Millions, we know, have now dropped out of the labor force during COVID. There's children, childcare considerations, healthcare, Zoom schooling. So super number of moving parts.
I think we saw this before. Earlier in the pandemic, there was a labor shortage in American factories. Are the same dynamics at play this time?
Yeah, bottlenecks is the euphemism, right? People were at home hoarding everything from furniture to backyard fire pits and picnic tables. And the manufacturers who made this stuff, they started the year oblivious to the huge shock that was coming down the pike. You think they'd be giddy, but they were sad because they couldn't provision all the demand. So you couldn't find home builders and contractors. Prices, we know, surged on eBay and the secondary market. So even within that huge economic calamity, there were these little boomlets that were uncomfortable for many people.
There are employers who are pointing to the latest COVID stimulus as a disincentive for people to come back to work. You know, they're getting these people who are unemployed getting $300 weekly boosts and unemployment benefits through the beginning of September. What do you think? Is that actually holding people back from going back to work?
I mean, for starters, I'm definitely hearing it from restaurant owners, and I think that's a great example. If suppose you need 40 hours a week from someone, but they're only willing to do half that because the $300 a week benefit more than makes up for hourly wages plus diminished tips. Many restaurants still aren't operating at full capacity. So now suppose you up the ante and you offered $600 a week and your servers and cooks had a cut of a brimming tip jar. I think this is going to be felt when these dining rooms open in full and are short-staffed at the very outset until and unless the owners pay up more.
And what about those incentives I mentioned? McDonald's in Florida offering $50 just to come into the interview. Do those work? Is that a good strategy?
They get press and they get traffic and applicants. You know, but if the competitor sweetens the wage pot after somebody signed on your dotted line, you're going to see these workers go to the competitor and the manager is going to have to shell out promotions and application time all over again. Meanwhile, you know, the drive-thru at McDonald's is still slammed and more customers want the stuff delivered to them. Many buying habits have changed vastly over the past 16 months.
It just makes me think maybe there's a silver lining here. If there is more competition for workers, might they get a higher wage?
It is, but you're also worried about the higher wages coming back when these companies don't have pricing power. They're also really desperate for customers to come back, and people are raring to consume. So it's going to be an interesting reconciliation, a readjustment that takes place in the roaring recovery that is anticipated over the next several months.
Oh, Robin Farzad, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The entire country is waiting a jury's decision on whether former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin should be convicted of murder and manslaughter charges after kneeling on George Floyd's neck last year until he died. George Floyd's death led to calls for police reform, but the police-involved killings of people of color has not stopped. The families of 20-year-old Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, and 13-year-old Adam Toledo in Chicago are the latest to call for police accountability. Let's get some perspective from Charles Wilson, chair of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for asking me.
Yes, yeah, so you know, with all that is happening in and around Minneapolis, including the Derek Chauvin trial and the police-involved killing of Dante Wright, how would you describe this moment we're in right now and our efforts to understand policing?
I would think disturbing is a mild way of saying it. Everyone I've spoken to over the last month and a half is very disturbed about what has taken place.
Can you say more about what you're disturbed by? Because depending on what side of this you're on, you may be zeroing in on different things when you think about how disturbing the issues that we're seeing involving policing is.
It's disturbing to us that people in communities of color are now wondering whether it's actually safe for them to even be around anybody in law enforcement, including us.
Last week, when you first saw the police body camera video that showed the killing of Adam Toledo in Chicago, what did you see?
What I saw was a kid with his hands up and nothing in him. Okay. My understanding is that there is supposedly another video that shows the kid with a weapon in his hand. I have not seen that. So the only video I have to go by is a video of a 13-year-old little boy with his hands up in the air getting shot by a police officer. That ain't supposed to happen. The institution of policing, as it is currently practiced in the United States of America, is inherently biased against people of color and low income, and it was designed to be that way. It has been that way for over 400 years. Until that foundation is accepted as fact, there is no way that we can move forward to make the appropriate changes in the culture of law enforcement that need to be made.
Do you see that as a universal fact that all law enforcement agrees upon?
All law enforcement doesn't agree on it. In fact, my counterparts are adamant that it's not true. Okay, Black cops have known this for years.
I want to step back a little bit and talk about some other things. Do you think that we'll ever see limits put on qualified immunity, which basically protects officers accused of crimes from being sued?
I believe it's coming. There's been several moves around the country to limit or, in fact, eliminate it in areas. What people have to understand is reform is coming to police work, whether you want it, whether you like it or not. It's coming.
After so many high-profile police-involved killings, has your faith in policing been shaken? I mean, I'm hearing you say that reform is needed, reform is coming. But what are your thoughts on the profession in general?
What the profession has to do is remodel the how and what we do. We have to remodel how we hire, who we hire. if you tell me that one of your primary candidates is a black female and you're not putting your recruiting information in the hair salons, fitness centers, and shopping centers where every single black woman I know goes at least once a week, you're not hiring for black females. We have to remodel what and how we train. We have consistently trained people to be warriors in the community as opposed to being guardians of the community, people who are there to help and assist people with their life's problems rather than people who go in and try to find ways to bulk up their records on how many arrests they can make or how many heads they can break. Supervisors have to be people who will, in fact, mentor the people under their command and hold them accountable. Because if your procedures and processes are bad, then everything else is bad.
A lot of work to be done. Charles Wilson is national chairman of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. Thank you so much.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Not sure if you've heard this, but almost one-fifth of the world's food ends up in the trash. And with Earth Day coming up on Thursday, we thought we'd take a look at how to minimize food waste in the kitchen with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunns. Hey, Kathy.
Hey, Peter. That is absolutely right.
Well, right. I mean, look, Kathy, we did this story last month. The UN report says the average person throws away about 163 pounds of food a year, which surprised us. What about you?
Yeah, it's shocking and it's incredibly disturbing. And, you know, aside from all the loss, there are the opportunities for improved food security and economic growth and environmental prosperity. It's a huge problem. And I don't know about you, but how often do you come home from a supermarket and you throw out the leafy green tops of beets or carrots or leeks, or you're just throwing out leftovers, or a carrot looks a little limp and you just chuck it? Well, I have three recipes today that kind of rethink that.
Well, I mean, to answer your question, every time, unfortunately, I come back from the grocery store. So let's do some of them quickly. Let's start with those carrot tops.
So carrot tops, I mean, I used to give them to a friend who had rabbits. It turns out they're very sweet. They have this pleasingly slight bitter taste, and they make an excellent pesto. And I whirled them up with some pistachios, olive oil, salt, pepper, Parmesan cheese. You can toss it with pasta or roast the carrots and then spread the carrot top pesto on top. Really simple and delicious. No waste.
Wow, sounds great. All right, how about this recipe that you have for muffins that use beet greens?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you grew up in the South, you know how fabulous beet greens are. They're stunning pink and green leaves. They're full of antioxidants. If you steam them or saute them with garlic and oil, they're fabulous. Here, I sauteed them and then added them to a very simple savory muffin mixture with sharp cheddar cheese and spring chives. And I also used the stems. This is another thing we tend to throw away. The stems on broccoli and beet greens and even radishes are delicious. They can be used in all kinds of cooking.
Now, those muffins sound great for something like breakfast, and we're going to link people to all of these recipes at hereandnow.org. But there's one more here, carrot peels and the asparagus ends. What are you going to do with those?
So, you clean your carrot, and then you're peeling it, and then you throw those peels away. But in fact, that's part of the carrot. So I made fresh vegetable rolls. Think of a fresh spring roll. It's kind of mimicked on that, where you take a rice paper wrapper, soak it in water, get it soft, layer it with lettuce and peelings of carrots and asparagus, some herbs, maybe some chopped pickles, radishes, roll it up like a burrito, and you've got a gorgeous fresh vegetable roll. And you make a very simple peanut sauce to go with that.
Wow. What else can we do?
Oh, you can do so much, but let me give you one quick tip. If you have a piece of paper or a whiteboard on your refrigerator and you make a list or some columns saying, use the broccoli by May 1st, Don't forget the leftover roast chicken for tacos. Mm. In other words, if you list the foods that are hiding in your refrigerator, you will tend to waste a lot less. It makes you more organized. And also, you need to rethink leftovers. Not as, I've said this before, not as old food, but food that's ready for a second act. And then all your little vegetable scraps, keep them. Make vegetable stocks, chicken stocks. You can reuse virtually everything.
We're going to do it. Kathy Gunst, thank you so much, as always.
Thanks, Peter.
Walter Mondale is being remembered as a public servant with wit and wisdom. Mondale served as President Jimmy Carter's vice president from 1977 to 1981. Here he is accepting the nomination as Carter's running mate at the Democratic Convention in New York in 1976.
We do not ask to govern because we are sure of the answers, but we ask to govern because we are able to look at our problems with fresh eyes. We are a new generation of leadership. We are strong, we are experienced, and we're ready.
Walter Mondale died yesterday at his home in Minneapolis. He was 93. And our next guest says he transformed the vice presidency into something more than a ceremonial role. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and he joins us now. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Julian, Jimmy Carter called Walter Mondale an invaluable partner. The New York Times says Mondale was the first VP to serve as a genuine partner to a president. How did he transform the vice presidency?
Well, he turned it from what was a running joke in Washington into what Jimmy Carter said was a dynamic policy-driving force. And he did lots of things. He insisted on being in the room where decisions were made. He worked on many key initiatives, from economic policy to negotiations over the Panama Canal treaties. And he insisted on things like getting all the paperwork that President Carter saw, being in the cabinet meetings, and even getting intelligence briefings. So by the end of Carter's presidency, the vice president was a major player in the executive branch.
I'm also guessing that he had a real partner in the president, in President Jimmy Carter at the time, because we're thinking about someone like Lyndon Johnson, who was a senator, like Mondale as well, perhaps the most powerful senator before he was John Kennedy's vice president. And yet Johnson wasn't able to do much in that role. Why was Mondale specifically different in being able to impart himself in this way?
Well, the key was that President Carter invited him to do this and accepted his demand, Mondale's demand, to be more than a figurehead. And part of it was Jimmy Carter had very weak ties to the Democratic establishment and to Washington. He really was an insider, and he didn't have much national experience. So he was eager to have Mondale help him with the job. It was also after Vietnam and Watergate, where the presidency was unstable and being attacked by many quarters. So Carter was fine with all hands on deck to make the presidency something better.
Hmm. You know, the other phrase we're hearing today about Mondale was that he was a champion of liberal politics. What does that mean?
He believed in government. He was influenced and shaped by the New Deal in the 1930s and the Great Society in the 1960s. And he believed that government had a role to play in making this a better country. And he was very honest about what that meant, famously in 1984 when he ran for president, saying he would have to raise taxes to pay for what the government was doing. But he wasn't defensive like so many Democrats have been since the 1980s.
I mentioned Mondale's wit. And here's an example. This was during the 1984 presidential campaign. During one of the debates, Senator Gary Hart had just listed some of his new policy ideas. And here's what Mondale said.
Mr. Glenn,
can I respond to that?
Well, we'll come back to you. Let some of the others.
What's new about coming out for entrepreneurs? You know, when I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Yeah.
Those of a certain age know that ad that he's talking about. It's a reference to Wendy's hamburger ad. Mondale went on to get the nomination but lost the election in a landslide to President Ronald Reagan. But he actually made history because he had picked a woman, a Geraldine Ferraro, as his running mate. With the little time we have, can you talk about the significance of that? Because this was 1984.
It was very important. It was still, for many people, inconceivable that you would have a female politician in line to be president. And he made that decision. He was the first to introduce that vice presidential nominee. And I think it opened doors. I think it created more possibilities, not just for vice presidential nominees, but for other positions as well. And today we have Vice President Kamala Harris right there in Washington as a living legacy of what that 84 campaign tried to do.
That's right. Ultimately, Julian, what do you think Mondale's legacy will be?
Well, he made the modern vice presidency, and I think that's his biggest legacy for all of us today. And he was a generation of liberal Democrats who believed in government without apology and in some ways set the foundation for what President Biden is doing in 2021.
Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.